You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM. Welcome back to the Batuta Advocate radio show, live from the Budgie Smuggler bedrooms where we remain in quarantine. They have opened up a few things in Queensland this week. Cafes, five people in the house, etc., etc. So unless you are an absolute psychopathic socialite, things should feel back to normal. Tattoo parlors, however, still closed.
And gun shops.
Gun shops and adult entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Your nephew would be a bit upset that they haven't opened up the knock shops yet.
Yeah, I know. He's gone broke. Anyway, the economy is suffering still in many places. There was talk initially by Morrison, once he'd finally gotten his talking points in order and had a narrative to present, that he was going to put a lot of Australian businesses into hibernation. That's what the JobKeeper package was going to help do. And it seems there hasn't been many complaints with the JobKeeper. I mean, you'll hear the occasional freelance Aztec folk artist complaining about not being able to get on JobKeeper.
Yep.
For the most part, people are... There's not much criticism. It's a bipartisan success story, a lot of people are saying. Now, this is just the tip of the iceberg, though. There's a lot more going on in the economy that that doesn't meet the eye unless you are one of those robots who walk around Martin Place. And today we have one of them joining us, Sky News business analyst, CNBC portfolio asset manager. What else have I missed there? Party boy? Thomas Madden, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, boys. I think that that pretty much sums it up. Thank you, Clancy. Anyways, how are you, boys? What's happening?
Not bad, Tommy. Mate, we're just trying to wrap our head around... basically, the markets, now that the worst of the COVID-19 in terms of the deaths have passed us, but now we really want to talk about another death that's kind of about to happen, and that's our wealth and probably our children's wealth, and certainly not, you know, the wealth of the older people that these big measures were brought in to essentially save from dying. So basically, we'd just like to start things off with the government has spent about $360 billion of their own money. Well, not really their own money. I'd like to ask you is that where did this $360 billion come from? Is this from like bonds or some
buried gold?
Yeah.
It's an interesting conundrum that we're in, you know, as unless you've been living under a rock, I'm sure that that all the listeners and you guys and the residents of Batuta are all aware that the government has been spending a ridiculous amount of money on essentially trying to prop up or keep the economy afloat, I guess.
Yeah.
Is probably a good way to describe it while COVID is affecting markets and economies globally. There's so many different, it's such a complex situation and I'm not a super genius, but I can try and, I guess, explain it the best way that I think that I can. And it's, so essentially, the government doesn't have money to be able to, you know, just it can create money out of thin air, but that causes inflation.
Zimbabwe, baby.
That's right.
That's more or less the Robert Mugabe school of economics, where if you don't have enough money, you just have to go and make some more.
You just keep printing. That's right, and you get 10 billion Australian dollar loaves of bread.
Yep. Real pangs of the Weimar Republic in there too. You know, just. Useless Deutschmarks, Reichmarks, whatever they were called.
That's right. Unless we want to turn into Germany after World War One, then we have to be kind of fiscally responsible for what we spend. Anyway, at the moment, the economy is basically not moving. We're GDP's negative. I think it's down 6% year on year. No one's making any money, which essentially means that the government doesn't make any money. They don't collect any tax receipts, but at the same time, they're having to spend crazy amounts of money to keep business afloat. As you guys mentioned before, JobKeeper's one of the initiatives. But all in all, it's costing the government about $4 billion a week is the figure that everyone, the news outlets seem to be running with, which is an insane amount of money.
Yeah.
We already had quite a bit of debt before this happened. Compared to the likes of other Western countries, we're actually, our debt pile's reasonably small when compared to GDP, but we still had quite a bit of debt. And essentially, I think the question that you asked was basically, where are we getting the money from?
Yeah, where's this money from?
what we do to raise money is obviously money doesn't grow on trees, and the government knows that. I think a lot of the time, I don't want to get too political in here, but a lot of people seem to think it does, and that they can find this money to, you know, to fund other things, or where did this money come from? You know, why isn't it being spent in better healthcare or social things? But it is because we need to invest the money, the debt that we raise, into profit-making or economy-boosting situations so that we can then pay that money back. We raise that money through the issue of bonds. We sell bonds to international banks, probably the Chinese.
Yep.
So the Chinese give us a shitload of money in return for bonds. They already own us anyways. They own all the property. They own all the best.
That's going to upset a lot of old-timers to hear that.
That's right.
And I think they should be clear about where this virus came from.
That's right.
We need an independent inquiry into Wuhan.
How can we really fuck these guys? I know. We'll create a super virus and force them to borrow shitloads of money and then... take over the country, which
was already happening. If you were living under a rock, it had already happened. So
that's not groundbreaking news, I think. So we raise the money from bonds from the Chinese.
Yeah,
we then pay to our people to keep the economy afloat, in the hope that everyone doesn't go bankrupt and the government can still get some tax receipts when this thing finishes. So that's where we get the money from.
So just another thing about the share market is that when all of this started to roll on, we did see a lot of investors start to sell their shares. You know, no one had any confidence in the market, and we just saw it go into free fall. But it's bounced quite heavily, though.
It has.
Yeah.
It has indeed. And it's one of those situations. I mean, again, I can give you... my opinion on markets and whatever, but no one really knows what's...
How come it went down and up, in your opinion, like so quickly?
Well, I think the story's yet to unfold properly.
Right.
When did you first start thinking, oh, no?
It was when the stock market kind of started falling. I think stock markets are a pretty good indicator of things like... you know, global flu viruses that kill lots of people. The Warren Buffetts of the world seem to know what's happening before the medical experts do. It's funny how that works out, and I don't know what their secret source is or their, you know, whatever it is, but markets started turning pretty significantly because it was already, this whole thing was already going on in China, right? We knew, everyone knew about COVID in was it November, I think, October last year. We all knew it, and we kind of thought, oh, it's going to be another SARS type situation. And markets actually rallied. The stock market rallied really hard towards the end of last year. So people didn't think it was going to be much of a big deal. Big ups to the Chinese government for keeping that under wraps and letting all their residents continue to travel globally, knowing that this thing was going to essentially eradicate the economies of most countries around the world.
That's an interesting opinion, but go on.
Thank you, China.
And Warren Buffett knew because he was in on it.
But him and Bill Gates.
That's right. Bill Gates created it. Him and his
and
robots.
5G too.
That's right, and 5G chemtrails and all that kind of stuff. So but the market started to turn in February, towards the end of February. Things were rallying until then, and then they turned in February, and that I think is kind of when to be honest, I started going, you know, we're everything's still open here, the economy's still ticking over, but there is this looming shadow of this, you know, this virus hanging over our heads. The market turned and it started going, oh, wait a second, maybe, you know, this is worse than we thought, or at least the fear of the virus is going to have knock-on effects. Like, I really think that the politicians were playing it day by day. Like, they didn't even know what they were doing, you know, 48 hours ahead. It wasn't some great big grand plan. It was like, oh, shit. One minute was like, guys, don't worry, we're fine. And the next minute was like, actually, we need to stop everyone going to school. That's right. And let people get haircuts and then not let people get haircuts and then let them get haircuts again. But that's, I think the markets kind of took a turn, and that's when everyone started going, hold on, the economic impacts for this thing are going to be huge. And the markets, yeah, they fell 30%. So it was pretty serious. It was the biggest fall since 1992, the crisis of 92. So
if you didn't have any shares, like a lot of young people in this country don't, because if you read the newspapers, every person under 30 in this country doesn't have any money and the world's against them. How do things like this affect people that don't have any shares or real exposure to the markets?
I mean, it doesn't. I don't want to get too deep on this thing, but I think we've had a prolonged period of economic growth, and it has benefited people that have assets. So people that own property, people that own shares, boomers, they've benefited really well. Government policy has essentially done nothing but aid and inflate the value of existing assets. So whether that be shares or property or anything that you can buy with leverage or that spits off cash flow has done incredibly well.
Yeah.
There's the kind of economic policy of perpetual economic growth has been the mantra for the last 30 years, which is capitalism, you know, tick, 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 whatever. It's been good. If you're
opposed
of that age bracket,
if you're in the market, which has now pushed
if you were a Howard Butler back then.
Yeah. That's right. And now young people, you know, the generation below, I think are struggling because we have overinflated asset prices. The government is willing to, seeming to expand or do everything that they can to protect property prices. That's left a lot of people out of the market. The recent downturn of 30%, you've got to remember the market rallied 18% in the last financial year. So back to markets. So really you're down, but what, you know, 12% or something. And it's bounced back since then. So you probably, if you look at where your share portfolio was a year ago, it's probably not that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that drastic. And like in a situation like this, and I'll keep talking on this, but we haven't even begun to see, in my opinion, the impacts of this in terms of what it's going to do on the economy. When they stop paying the JobKeeper allowance, this thing is going to just, you know, in my opinion, we've seen a bit of a bat, we've seen a bit of a recovery, but we're going to see a whole nother level, a whole new low.
Yeah.
When we try and fight our way out of this thing. And then longer term, we've got to think about paying back all this debt and paying the interest on these or the yield on these bonds that we've issued to pay for all this stuff. So
that brings me to my next question, Tom. You know, in a post-apocalyptic coronavirus recession, would you see yourself as a kind of inner city, I am legend type Will Smith or like a motorbike riding cyberpunk like Mad Max?
Or a zombie?
I'm a zombie. I'm joining you. I'm walking around the city. I'm eating people. I'm a cannibal, doing whatever it takes to keep myself alive. Very selfish.
Not much different to what you are now as a stockbroker in Martin Place, mate.
That's right. A soulless suit. Who only cares about himself? That's right. So I think I'll be commanding a zombie horde of sorts.
Portfolio manager. This is where we first saw you. You often do a lot of stuff for CNBC,
and Sky
News. What actually is your job for last week? We had the world's fastest bowler on the radio show. Mm-hmm. The week before that, we had former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. You kind of sit somewhere between those two people.
He's a big time robot, though. That Malcolm. I hate Peter. I hate Peter. Beep, beep, beep. Fuck you, Matthias.
Hello, no, Malcolm.
Beep, beep, beep.
I've got some...
You're a fucking robot.
there's some pretty esteemed guests you have on this podcast. So I appreciate that. As a portfolio manager, essentially I'm in control of wealthy people's investments,
money.
So their money. So whether that be term deposits, if they're investing in shares, investing in bonds, whatever it is that they require to continue to keep themselves wealthy and make money, that's I'm the one that that handles those investments for them and works out, you know, how much risk they want to take on and how aggressive they want to be with their investment style and then everything down to the individual investments themselves. So what companies to invest in, what fixed income products or bonds to buy. So that's, I'm in control of that. And I guess the, more importantly, I mean, I manage the relationships with those individuals. So
now you weren't working in the space you're in 2008. You might've just been, you just, I guess at that point you were still working on the farm, but now you haven't seen a proper recession in your time.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's my first time being, I guess, invested in the markets, watching.
How exciting.
Yeah, it's where I pop my cherry.
your yeah, recession, my recession cherry.
It was awesome. On a more serious note, I think, This recession's different to a lot of the other recessions we've had. Certainly, the 2008 financial crisis. Just on the back of this, this is a recession that people can see and feel. Like you walk down the street, everyone knows about the virus. Everyone's scared of the virus. You're not going to work because of the virus. You walk down the street. I know things are opening up now, but a couple of weeks ago, you saw the shops close. There was no one on the street. So people, in a way, in a weird way, economically, were more comfortable with it because they know that, like, for instance, that in 2008, the GFC was caused by greedy investment bankers and back offices trading things called CDOs holding these, and there was credit default swaps, and there was, you know, people holding these large piles of very bad investments, banks holding these bad investments that were worth nothing. That, you know, but people, the everyday mum and dad didn't know what was going on. They're like, okay, what are these things?
Yeah. What are investment bankers? 10 years, and then they watched The Big Short twice.
That's right. They watched The Big Short. That's right. And then you had Margot Robbie telling you what a CDO is in a bathtub or whatever it was. So people didn't know. They kind of go, right, there's this weird financial crisis happening behind the scenes. There seems to be people in Florida that have left the keys in the doors of their homes, which is weird. But other than that, it was kind of like the crisis was felt. It was a credit crunch. It was felt by banks. They couldn't lend money. They couldn't afford to pay out money to people they owed money to, et cetera, et cetera. So it was people knew it was going on, but Dad and Dave from Batuta Ponds didn't know what had actually happened.
Yeah,
I think the difference between 2008 and this crisis is people are almost have come to terms with it a little better. Certainly. Economically and with their share portfolios or their investment portfolios, because at least they know what it is. It's not to do with, you know, fraudulent CDOs that they don't even have any idea of or concept of what that means to the economy. But it's like, yes, I can't open my shop today, so I understand that the economy is having troubles. It's a kind of a real in-your-face financial crisis because
it's great to be able to blame
you can
China.
See it. You can feel it. But you know what I mean? Like, so people, I think, which in a way makes people more comfortable with it because it's not something that they can't control. It is something they can see and they can control. and that kind of, which means they feel a little more comfortable with it. But I also don't think that we've felt the full extent of this thing yet.
Fuck.
So how bad do you think it can get? I mean, like, things probably can't get much worse, really.
Incorrect. Try again.
Well, I think that Clancy is laughing quite nervously.
Big time. It's like shorten.
Can you paint us a picture of what the absolute worst case scenario is moving forward, like 1 or 2 years in the future?
Well, first of all, I don't think. You guys need to be worried up there in Batuta, especially with a largely online digital following with a reasonably low cost base. I don't know how good your 5G connection is up there, but I think Clancy, you should
it's good enough to protest.
you shouldn't be too worried. I think you guys will be fine. The rest of the economy, I'm not sure. My guess is as good as any, and no one knows how this thing's going to unfold, and I guess it'll be a real testament to see, you know, how our government, or a testament to them to see how well they can pull us out of this thing. But I think we've issued something like $400 billion in bonds, for one thing. That is going to take decades to pay back. So we'll have a budget deficit for decades now.
That's good to hear.
So in the long term, the only way they can pay that back is by taxes and raising taxes, and they've got a great excuse to do it now with coronavirus. Again, as I said before, mm-hmm. people can see it, they can feel it, so they go, yeah, I guess it makes sense. We better pay more in tax so we can pay back the effects. So again, another way for the boomers, just as they're coming into their cushy retirement with their overinflated assets, they remove themselves from the workforce and then we get to pay it back. So that's one thing. That's nice. But
it's our duty.
That's our duty. That's right. But it can. I think in the short term, it's going to be a lot worse for the economy. JobKeeper, for instance, they're reviewing it already. It's only just been, you know, installed, and they're reviewing it already. It's costing the government $4 billion a week.
They've realised what, a month into JobKeeper, holy shit, we've just done 4 Kevin Rudd stimulus packages.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that you can see, like, look at Josh Frydenberg when he gets on TV. Look how fucking nervous that dude looks. Like, everyone else, don't you? Like, I mean,
it's a tough job.
All the state premiers are kind of up there going, yeah, we've saved lives today. Everyone's doing a great job. Everyone can start getting back to normal. Clap, clap, clap. Woohoo. Happy times. But what scares me is when you see Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg get up there and you go, holy shit. Look how fucking scared these guys are. They've had this stimulus package in for a couple of weeks. And look at his face. He looks like he's about to fucking explode. And I think you can see how nervous he is. So what's going to happen is they're going to wind this. They're going to wind the economic stimulus packages back and the JobKeeper packages back. They'll stop paying it. That's, I think, initially when you're going to see a real pinch. We've had 600,000 people become unemployed since the start of March, and we've got 5.5 million people on JobKeeper. They don't include the people on JobKeeper as unemployed. They're still counted as people employed, but there's been 600,000 people.
So basically employed. A quarter of the population are experiencing...
Exactly right. So what's going to happen is when a quarter of the population are essentially unemployed, they're treading water with the JobKeeper. As soon as they turn that off and we see how the economy and if the economy gets back to normal, that's when you're going to see, like, I think we've already got 9% unemployment at the moment. When you drop those 6 million people back into the ocean and see if they can swim, I think you're going to see some serious problems.
That's when we start seeing ram raids.
Yeah, 100%.
As you were saying before, the government looks to get out of this by introducing just some new temporary taxes or a levy. Are there any other ways for governments to try and turn the economy around? Like, as we have kind of seen in the past, especially in New South Wales, they were able to turn around their useless economy with these massive infrastructure projects. Mm. Kind of moving forward, do you think that the federal government and indeed the state governments around the country might look to start building things again?
I think they will. I think we've actually done a reasonable job, you know, even before this COVID stuff. If you walk around, you know, central Sydney and have a look at all the construction that's going on, they're building metro stations, there's new infrastructure, there's the light rail.
Yeah, they're doing underground rail in Brisbane too. That's just firing up now.
Yeah, like it's all... So I think they definitely know...
Why?
They know how to...
It's busy, mate.
We've got so much space.
Man, they're trying to stimulate the economy. Where do they stop? Like, they're probably, you know. But anyway, so they are already spending money on, you know, on things to stimulate the economy. You know, I guess they'll continue to do that. But again, it all costs money. So if the government want to invest and try and stimulate the economy again, it costs money. They have to do, like, quantitative easing is, it's a really boring topic,
yeah. But
essentially if the government wants to do stuff like, you know, investing in infrastructure, then they have to borrow money from central banks who buy bonds off them that they have to pay back in the future. So it's kind of, that can definitely happen, but it still has to be, you know, paid back. People have to get, the central banks are separate from government. And they are required to, you know, they don't give free loans. They have to be accountable for money supply and spending and limit inflation and all these various kind of parameters that they have that they have to control. If the government's not getting any tax receipts, like they're not now because no one's paying any tax, everyone's getting JobKeeper and businesses have stopped, they don't have money. So they need to get the system back going again as quickly as possible. Otherwise, we could have a serious depression and, you know, and who knows what happens. So I think we as the virus, as bad as the virus is, we need to get the economy open and moving pretty quickly.
Now, Madden, there was one interesting thing that's kind of come out of this whole virus. I guess you'd say the blinkers that a lot of people have put on, particularly seen in America, but it's starting to happen in Australia and the UK as well, where people who are suffering, who are in a bad place because of this virus and the lockdowns that come with it, are just kind of pretending it's not happening. And they're starting to just call for, you know, their liberties and their freedom. Obviously, goes right against the advice of medical experts, but that's just how desperate they are. You know, this is a lockdown. This is a conspiracy. This is, you know, a fascist state. Have you seen much of that kind of chat from like a, you know, from your end of town? Because I imagine it's just as easy for someone in an air-conditioned office to think the same way. Like, just let them get back to work. Let people get back to work. Elon Musk has been doing a little bit of it, in fact.
Yeah. I think it's not, there's not really that type of chat in my inner town. There's a lot of questions over the economy. I think people are worried about the economy, which is not to be underestimated. People, the tendency is life over the economy, but the two are more intertwined, you know, than you think. I think from our point of view, it's, I want to see things get open as quickly as possible so we can get the economy back working, because you're kind of looking at what's going on and going, it's all very well and good. We're keeping people safe, and I understand that, and that's a great thing, you know, protecting life and stopping the spread of this thing. But you've got to remember, at to what cost? So, like, if there are 6 million unemployed Australians after this whole thing, and there is, you know, all the businesses have gone bankrupt, and we lose the life that we've become comfortable to enjoying, goes away. You know, these have been looked at times of great expansion, and everyone has lots of money and stuff.
Yeah.
But really, what happens to you? What's the emotional cost of having 6 million unemployed people? How many people, for instance, and this is an awful topic, but how many people are going to be depressed? How many people might commit suicide? How many families are going to have?
What are they saying in the states?
On the back of all this, so
for, in the states, for every 1% rise in unemployment in the United States, 40,000 people die.
That's right. So you've got to, and that's why they're intertwined. So you look at the spread of a virus, which is bad. But then you've got to look at the knock-on effects of the economy, which it sounds like this cold, robotic thing. You're like, oh, you know, fucking stockbroker only cares about the economy and his shares going up. Yeah. That's not true. It's more, you know, we're kind of, I think, at work looking at it as a whole and going, shit, there's going to be knock-on effects to this that are beyond, you know, a few people getting sick, as bad as that is. But it's like 6 million unemployed. How many families are going to be disadvantaged on the back of that? And what's the impact then on everything, not just the economy, but your fabric of life and how everyone operates? So there's a lot to consider.
You mentioned before just about you know, when mum and dad feel the pinch, mum and dad investors feel the pinch, and how maybe they felt it during the GFC, but they couldn't really see it and touch it. One element of the Australian economy, one like almost imperative element, is the housing market, which seems to have you know, a lot of people are invested and very interested in how this thing's going to pan out. What are your thoughts there? Because this is going to be the one thing that we can all touch and feel.
Well, I find it crazy. The property market hasn't been affected yet, so shares have obviously come down. Bond yields are coming down because people are worried about the ability of governments to repay loans, and they've also, with quantitative easing, as I mentioned before, and other forms of kind of economic stimulus, that also causes interest rates to come down. What essentially that means for property owners is that debt is cheaper, and so the perceived response has been seen the property market not move at all. I can't see that continuing. As I said before, it's all very well and good if everyone's got jobs, interest rates are low, property keeps rising. So mum and dad investors that own their own properties or have investment properties are safe at the moment. But if there is 6 million people unemployed, you can't tell me with a straight face that people aren't going to default on their home loans.
Yeah, so that could be, say, 3 million mortgages not getting paid and 3 million landlords not getting paid.
Exactly right. Yeah. And if you look at the fact that 6 million unemployed, you've got to remember that the participation rate in employment is, so we have the Australian population is 25 million. The workplace mm-hmm. participation rate is not 25 million. We don't have 25 million people ready, willing to work. So if you look at that 6 million, it actually gets a lot more dire when you look at the fact that there's probably only 16 million participating Australians in the workplace. They're people considered actively working or looking for work. So that figure becomes a lot worse when you look at it from that metric. And then you're telling me people are saying that property is holding up really well. It's a safe asset. Nothing ever goes wrong. People borrow money at incredibly low rates to invest in property. It's, people leverage, unlike shares, for instance, which you buy with the spare money you have, people leverage themselves up incredibly to buy property. So you might earn $50,000, but you buy a $600,000 house. So you've borrowed, you might have saved 50 grand, and then the rest of it you borrowed from a bank. So you've borrowed a shitload to be able to buy that asset, which then pushes up the asset prices. If 6 million people, let's call it 30% of the participating workforce, become unemployed, I don't see how property can still be at the levels that it is now, because who the hell can afford to borrow $600,000 to buy a property when they don't have a job?
Yeah.
So I think...
Yeah, but can the government afford to let these asset prices go down? Because if they go down, there's going to be millions of people who are paying a giant mortgage on a property that's worth 30% less. And if they're not going to really open the country up to immigration, which it is looking like on both sides of the parliament are pretty keen on trying to minimize immigration moving forward, how does a government look to remedy that? I mean, like, you can't really have all these people owning an asset that's worth
nothing.
Absolutely nothing, that they've got a giant mortgage on. I mean, you know, that's just going to be a replay of 2008.
And that's what I mean. And that's why I'm saying I don't think we're finished with all this yet. And if that happens, it's bad juju. I don't see how...
It is the worst type of juju in the world, Tom.
Yes, that's right. Very, very bad juju. I don't understand how it can happen. But the government have done an incredible job over the last 30 years letting... We didn't even suffer really in the GFC here in Australia on the back that property prices continue to go up. So the government, I think that's the price you pay for a protectionist policy. Like, investments aren't made risk-free. They're supposed to be risk. Historically, property didn't always perpetually grow up. Like, you listen to our parents talk about when they bought their first home. My mum bought her first place. It was a house in Potts Point, a house on Victoria Street in Potts Point. She bought it for, it was $220,000, which in 1989 or whenever it was. She doesn't still own that house, which is a damn shame. But those terrace houses in Potts Point are worth about $6-7 million now. So you can't tell me that, like, we haven't seen a correction. Historically, property prices went up, then there was a crash or something went wrong and they went down again. Then they went up, then they went down again. It was a volatile looking kind of graph. But you look at it for the last 30 years with things like the government has implemented negative gearing, so that there's tax breaks for having negatively geared properties. We're the only country in the planet that does that. We've had record low interest rates for the last 15 years. So they have done literally everything in their power to keep that asset going up. And I think now you potentially see the cost of doing that. You know, there's no such thing as a risk-free investment, including homes, as safe as you like to think that people like to think that that investment is.
Well, boomers like to think that there is such thing as a risk-free investment.
Yeah, they do. They do because they've had that. Their properties haven't gone down since they bought them. So that's where all the wealth creation comes from. The government definitely doesn't want to see that stop, because then again, like everything, they're going to stop. They make a lot of money from property, stamp duty and you know, various sales taxes, whatever it is. To when you sell a property, if the values go up, it's done in percentages, so you pay more. So they love it, but it would be detrimental if we saw that crash. But is it a necessary crash? You know, potentially. Eventually, the Band-Aid has to be ripped off. The fact that, you know, you can't just buy a property, gear up to your eyeballs, buy a property and have it perpetually go up in value. That's not the point of investing. And if it is, then we should all buy property, borrow as much money as humanly possible, which is wrong, you know, metaphorically, and buy a house. If it never goes down and the government protects it, fuck, why not? Borrow $2 million.
Things look pretty grim here. Magic can happen. We never know. We might be able to you know, a world war might start, which will distract everyone and fix everything. But just as a, you know, on a final note, how far off do you think we are from just blaming immigrants and poor people for this?
And China.
Yeah. Well, that's already happening.
Yeah, that's right. Fucking China. Look, I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is that China fared very well through this whole thing.
Which means they don't look good.
They're lending a lot of money and they're building super highways or whatever it is they're doing around the planet. So we should all start speaking Mandarin.
Problem solved.
And quickly.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Tom Madden, AusBiz analyst, CNBC contributor, portfolio manager based down there in Martin Place, the beating heart of this vast nation. We're excited, nervous about things to come, as I think everyone should be. It's not over till the fat lady sings. Also means it's not over until the housing market crashes. So thank you for joining us, mate. This has been very interesting, very educational.
Thank you, Clancy. Thank you, Errol. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Thanks, Tom.